Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the Ides of November, Anno Domini 2014. You, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Brian Meehan.
And we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick up your shoes. Don't get the blues. We're going to start with the... I should mention we have Brian in for Dave, who is one step ahead of the law, somewhere, I believe, in the southeast today. Probably galloping across the badlands of New Mexico. Actually, that'd be the southwest. All right, the U.S. government warned iPhone and iPad users on Thursday to be on the alert for hackers who may exploit a vulnerability in Apple's iOS operating system that would enable them to steal sensitive data. There was the potential for hacks using a newly identified technique known as the mask attack, the government said in an online bulletin from the National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Center and the U.S. Computer Emergency Response or Readiness Team. The network security company FireEye disclosed the vulnerability behind the mask attack earlier this week, saying it had been exploited to launch a campaign dubbed Wire Lurker and that more attacks could follow. Hackers could potentially steal login credentials, access sensitive data stored on iOS devices, and remotely monitor activity on those devices, the government said. Such attacks could be avoided if Apple and iPad and iPhone users only installed apps from Apple's App Store or from their own organizations, it said. Users should not click install from pop-ups when surfing the web. If iOS flashes a warning that says untrusted app developer, users should click the Don't Trust and immediately uninstall the app, the bulletin said. Meanwhile, Apple has released a statement pointing out that the mask attack isn't really a flaw at all and that it's not aware of anyone who's actually been affected by the attack. So are you worried about the mask attack? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299 or toll-free at 1-800-790-0415. I realize that it is not easy to get, and I realize that it's not something you're going to catch from Apple's own app store and stuff like that. But I think not calling it a flaw and telling people, oh, don't even worry about it, is pretty disingenuous of Apple.
That does bring it down, although I do like that it has a nice, exciting name. That kind of brings a little bit more newsworthy to it. But it's still the same security practice that you've been telling users of Soundbites for years now. Don't trust things that you don't know their origins from.
That's exactly right. Those of you who are Apple users, don't get in a tizzy about this. But really, exercise the same care you've been exercising and maybe just a little bit more about where you get your apps from and what you install on your machine. And rather than just constantly blowing by any messages on your screen with a next or yes, read them.
That would require a little time.
Oh, well, I know.
And everybody else is in such a darn hurry. It's click, 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 and then they're reinfected.
Yep. And we see it all the time. How did I get reinfected? You installed something. No, I didn't. Then what's this toolbar that I took off already last week?
But I want to see the goldfish. I want to click the yes button. Yeah. Yes, I want to see the goldfish.
Exactly. So we really all need to be a little more careful. And seriously, people, you're supposed to be adults. Take some responsibility. I know. All right, to the phones. Our first caller is Mark from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Mark. What's up?
Hi, guys. I am having an issue with the unholy intersection of Apple products and Windows.
Well, thanks for calling. Next.
This is, I keep a few dozen contacts on my iPod Touch so that, you know, I can look up phone numbers and addresses and that sort of thing. And the easiest way to enter those has been on my Windows 7 laptop by using the contacts folder and users. That worked fine because iTunes would sync everything back and forth nicely. A couple of months ago, the Windows 7 laptop died, and I had to replace it with Windows 8, which I have done my best to learn as little about as possible, just
wise
enough
man.
To get it configured so it looks more like Windows 7. And then I noticed that the iTunes was no longer syncing the contacts. Changes in either device, either on the laptop or the iPod Touch, were not communicated. I tried to go ahead and replace everything on the iPod with the contacts on the laptop. Didn't do anything. So I suspect that iTunes in Windows 8 is no longer looking at the contacts folder. And the question is, where is it looking? And is it this in this people app that I see vague mentions of when I go on the internet and try to research this?
The people app is the new contacts app. In the past, have you been using Outlook or just your?
No. These are just the contact files. I use Thunderbird as my email client.
Okay. You may actually have a much simpler solution to this than using iTunes to port your contacts back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Apple's iCloud control panel will install on Windows, and you can point that to a particular storage of contacts, in this case your Thunderbird mail database, and have it sync through the iCloud control panel.
Okay, I don't actually want to sync with Thunderbird. I only am interested in what's I have in the contacts folder.
Okay. Then you can go ahead and point it towards that, and iCloud will take care of the synchronization for you. No cable needed.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. I'll take a crack at that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
There you go. It's easier than it sounds. Again, one of those simple solutions that, as long as you actually know what the magic thing is that lets you do that, that's one of the problems that I find. And it's not just Apple now. It's Windows. It's everybody. Nobody gives you a manual anymore.
I was just going to say that. Do you miss the days of having documentation with your product?
Yep.
And I'm going to call Apple out on the carpet here. They are notoriously not as good at making documentation for their products to work on the Windows ecosystem.
Yep. And that's been true for a while. And yet, you know, you would think, how much easier would it be to sell Apple products to Windows users if the products work together better?
Sure. I mean, do you remember the launch of iTunes on Windows and how the iPod really took off then?
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of Windows users out there.
And I mean, I get it. You know, they would rather you buy all Apple equipment. I do completely understand that. But the reality is a lot of people aren't going to.
Correct.
I think what we need to see is everybody's got to get out of this attitude of mine or the highway, you know.
It's everyone's sandbox. Let's all play nice.
Yeah, it would be really nice. But we're seeing some of that. Microsoft has recently said they love Linux. I'll believe that when hell freezes over.
I even saw a email yesterday about Visual Studio being open, portions of the API being available for open source platforms.
Yeah, pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. The day when you could start doing Visual Studio development on your Mac computer, that would be it's going to get some sweaters around here.
Yeah, exactly. And one thing that Apple that Microsoft has always done exceptionally well is build good developer tools. Really, of the three platforms, the best tools are honestly on Microsoft.
And great platform. Developer support. I mean, there are evangelists out there. You know, the Steve Ballmer dance. Developers.
Mm-hmm.
They've got people out there that want to recruit you as a developer.
Yeah, and they really do support them. The problem is, of course, then you turn around and you realize that, again, the tools work best if you're developing for Windows. They don't work well if you're developing for a Mac, you're developing for Linux. And I guess that's fair, too. But what we need is for the Mac community and, to a certain extent, the Linux community. I mean, Linux has had the same tools forever, and they're well-formed and they're well-used. But even so, on both the Mac side and the Linux side, to develop the kind of tools and particularly, as you say, the kind of support that Microsoft gives its developers would be ideal.
It would be interesting to see in the open source community which companies would come around to rally those resources for developers? You know, do you see the Oracles of the world or the SGI or even the big companies that use open source products like Walt Disney Studios and Pixar?
Yep. Yep. No, and I see that, and that would be ideal. Of course, now you're going to run into the problem of let's say, what our first caller was having trouble with. Somebody else is going to put out a product that will let you sync your iTunes through Windows 8, and that might be great, but then they aren't really constrained by iTunes, are they? If they wanted to add in Google Music or, I don't know, any one of a dozen other sources.
Yeah, there's that walled garden approach that Apple's taken to their iTunes library, and I guess because of licensing, they really have to have some sort of protection mechanism around it. I can understand that.
Well, but I'm not talking about the fact of the stuff that's in iTunes. What I mean is if somebody else made say Google Music as easy to use as iTunes for Mac people as well as for Windows and Linux people, I think that would be a threat.
If all the world were a web page.
Well, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. And okay. We're seeing more of that too, you know, as more people live with their tablet devices, whether they're iPads or Nexus 7s or whatever they are, or something with a touch screen, we're finding more and more instances where people just want to be able to go that or that or that, right?
You know,
and just point to it and get it.
You bring up a good point. I was discussing this just the other day, that users have started to take a look at a really, really well-specced computer, something that's definitely on the higher end of things. And after using a tablet device or a phone, a flagship phone or tablet device, or even a Chromebook, go back to the high-end laptop with the spinning hard drive and say, gosh, this thing's really slow.
Yeah.
And because you get that immediate response on a phone and you get that immediate response on a tablet, everything else feels slower. And that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
We've been conditioned that way.
Yep, and I completely agree with you. There's also that ability to touch. And the problem is people don't want a full touch interface on a laptop.
No, I don't want to have to touch.
Right.
It's nice to from time to time.
Right. And that's exactly my point. Because, you know, if I'm looking at something on the screen and I just want to make it bigger, or I want to just tap hello or, you know, next or whatever.
Or I want to sign a document.
Or I want to sign a document. I want to be able to do that. I don't want to have to touch all the time, because that act of reaching out your hand uses muscles that most people don't use regularly. And so consequently, you're going to find that people will go back to the keyboard or back to the mouse for most things.
I don't know. Anybody who's done support on non-touchscreen computers can tell you that plenty of users think they are touchscreens after having to clean them enough times.
And that's the bad part about touchscreens, isn't it? If it's our phone or a tablet, we can just wipe it on our stomachs or whatever. But if it's a desktop or a laptop, you just get that grease all over it. It's kind of horrible, particularly for those of us who are at our computers 12 or 15 hours a day and eat or drink. Right. Exactly. So, but we're seeing more and more of that. I did something this year that I haven't done in 20 years. I bought myself a Windows laptop, and I know
there's a support group for that.
Yeah, there is. It's called the Linux Users Group or Apple Cider. I know that, but. So I did it for the first time, and it came with a touchscreen. And I thought, I'll never use this.
And
I do, for certain things, particularly if I'm on a form, on a web page, and it's big enough. Now, remember, you know, if you've got tiny little lists, you can't use your finger.
And that's the other thing that developers need to realize, is that we are in a touch world, and developing that touch-friendly interface is the difference between users wanting to use your website and going to the competition.
That's exactly right. But as long as it's large, then I find myself tapping as much as I do anything else. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Tom from Penfield, New York. Welcome, Tom. What's up?
How you doing today?
Peachy, how are you?
Oh, pretty good. I finally got a smartphone a few weeks ago. It's a Verizon Android.
Yep.
And I'm realizing that if I go on a trip now, maybe I can leave my laptop at home and just take my phone with me and use that without taking a laptop along. But there's one issue I've got Ubuntu, and I've got a password keeper called Seahorse on there, and I'm trying to figure out how I could get the information for my passwords from my Ubuntu computer to my Android phone. I don't think there's a Seahorse application for Android, but do you have any suggestions on that?
That's a very, very good question. Wow. There are alternatives to Seahorse on the Android as well. I believe there is Seahorse for the Android.
I looked and I couldn't find it, so I'm assuming it's not there, but I'm not sure if there's Seahorse for Android or not. I could, yeah. Didn't find it in the Place store.
Oh, you got it, yeah.
I think the Seahorse app on Android is a photo app, but one,
yeah,
one that you might look at that is cross platform would be Keeper or 1Password
or KeePass, KeePass.
Yeah, not Keeper, KeePass. Thank you.
Yeah,
I looked at those, but I didn't know, you know, to exporting me when I go to Seahorse on my Ubuntu computer,
yeah,
and I go to the exports function, it's grayed out. So I've been trying to figure out how to actually export my information from that, because the idea that the keys always confuse me. I just have my password stored in there individually.
Right.
I don't have, so, and there's no export function that works in Seahorse. There are a couple of folders with files in them that I've in the past restored those to get my passwords back when I had a hard drive failure. But actually exporting the individual passwords, I'm not sure how to do that. So,
yeah, hold on. We've got to take a quick break. Don't hang up. We'll come right back to you in just a couple of minutes. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Brian Meehan, Nick Francesco, Tom from Penfield, and you. 20 minutes after the hour, Soundbites member supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Brian Meehan.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we are sound bites, and we have Tom from Penfield, New York, on the line about Ubuntu and Seahorse and maybe something along the lines of KeePass. He's still there? Tom?
Yes, I'm still here.
All right.
I'm here.
Here's the thing. KeePass, Seahorse is actually just a front end for the GNOME key ring.
Okay.
And so what we're trying to find, if there is some sort of utility that will take stuff directly out of the key ring and store it into KeePass.
Okay.
Because you can then, when you create a thing in KeePass, you give it a password, right? Because you have to unlock it every time. And mm-hmm. then that file called whatever you named it .kdb can be moved to any machine. So, for example...
That might be an issue, because the way I use Seahorse,
yeah.
I just store individual passwords in there.
Yeah,
I've never really gotten the way... key rings are supposed to work,
and that's not a problem.
Yeah,
because once you export them, and if you can, and I think Brian found something.
Yeah, there's a open source project called Keyring to KeePass, that will export your files using a script from the Ubuntu Keyring into the KeePass program. And once you're in the KeePass program, there's a number of different plugins available, including KeePass for Android app, KeePass to Dropbox, or any one of the different cloud data providers.
Is this a terminal window key in to do this?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, the key ring to KeePass, yes. KeePass, by the way, is KeePass.
Okay.
If you're looking for it, it's key ring to, key ring, the number two, KeePass, KeePass. And okay. That's a command line program that you run once. Once everything's in KeePass, there's a version of KeePass, like Brian said, there's a version of KeePass for Linux, for Windows, for Android, for iOS, for everything. So you can copy the database around or use a plugin like KeePass to Dropbox to keep one copy of your KeePass database, say, up on Dropbox and open it anywhere you like.
Okay.
Once they're in KeePass, I use KeePass all the time, and very much like you do, I mostly just store my username and my password. There's a nice section for comments if you want to, write a little bit of comment on it, but it isn't required to use, of course. And believe me, give KeePass a look. It's a very simple, very easy to use program. And like I said, you can copy the database to any other machine you want. It'll keep the same password so that, whatever password you set on your Windows machine would also go on your phone.
Okay. Does this keep it synchronized between the computer and the phone?
Well, no. Like I said, there's a couple of add-ons that Brian found. That one of them will synchronize your database to Dropbox. Another will synchronize it somewhere else. So you can do the synchronization that way pretty easily and transparently in the background.
I use Dropbox as my medium to tie all my devices together. So right. I have a password manager on my Mac, a password manager on my iPad, and a password manager on my Android, and they all go back to the same database file that lives in Dropbox.
And right. Dropbox is a free application you can get for everything?
Dropbox yep. is a web storage provider. You can go to dropbox.com and sign up for a free account. 2 gigs should be enough for all of your passwords.
Okay. All right. Well, that gets me off on the right foot, I think. I'll look into it and see if I can make it work.
Very good.
Yep. Good luck.
Thanks for calling.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. And there is a Dropbox for Android. There's a Dropbox for Windows, Dropbox for Mac, but Dropbox for whatever.
Even Dropbox for Windows Phone.
Even Dropbox for the Windows Phone. Man, you know they're dedicated if they'll have a Dropbox for that.
Either I'm imagining things. I thought, sure, I was just curious. I don't know why. Just because. Windows 10.
Yeah.
I had a few folks. Matter of fact, one caller called me at the shop before I was leaving, wondering about getting another system, and I wasn't. Of course, I was on my way out, so I couldn't look it up, and I looked it up here, and I know he's going to be listening. But yeah, now it looks like the release for Windows 10 is going to be like April, May.
Yeah, and I think that's the beta.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. They're kind of vague there. But anyways, they're, a lot of it, folks are waiting because they don't want to go to Windows 8 and getting a system with Windows.
Windows 8 has kind of gotten a bad rap. Yes, it does not have a start menu. There are applications you can run to add a start menu. You can also, with one simple command in Windows 8.1, set it up so that every time you boot up, it goes to the desktop, not to that stupid modern interface. So all you're really missing is the start menu. And there are workarounds for that. So the people who are still sitting on, and I know some of them are sitting on Windows XP still.
I got a friend right now.
The choice between running something that doesn't work perfectly and running something that is wide open to every idiot with a virus available to him, it, to me, is a no-brainer. Go with Windows 8. It's better than having an open hole in your machine for everybody who wanders by.
Well, I think everybody will get 8.1 now anyways,
right,
which you can then, like you say. But the biggest thing, I think, for the majority of the folks, because they've gotten so complacent from day one, is being able to click on that start button.
Well, you know what?
You know,
but there's your choice.
Yeah.
You can
I'm just saying, this is what I'm hearing.
No, I get it. I get
you
it.
Know, and,
but and what I'll say to you is you're not dumb. You're a smart person. You learned the start menu, and you can learn something else, too.
And when you click on the Windows flag in the lower left-hand corner, it still shows you all your apps. If you click on, or if you tap the Windows key on your keyboard, not only do you see all your apps, but the search is far improved over the existing start menu search in Windows 7. In that it can look through documents, pictures, metadata in different applications, as well as all of your apps. I find that after about 20 minutes or so of getting used to Windows 8.1, I can navigate it as quickly or quicker than I could in 7.
Yeah, like I say, it's, but some folks are just very resistant to any change or anything else. And
no, and I get that, but really considering how wide open your system is, you know, it's much like saying, oh, I don't use a wallet because I don't like them. I just carry all my cash in my hands when I walk down the street at night. It's
yeah.
You know, you got to make your choice, I guess.
And like I say, Windows 8.1, with a few modifications, can look pretty darn close to your Windows 7 or even your Windows XP. Yes, they are going to see some changes. They've done that from version to version within the control panel. Like it used to be add, remove programs. Now it's programs and features.
Right.
You know, the same thing. It's just like you've always said about a car. You know, the controls might be in a different position.
But you still know how to drive.
And it's just learning where those new positions
just
are.
Just learning where the radio is. Yeah. It's really that simple. And for those of you who are still on XP, what was your excuse for not going to 7?
My version of Quicken 2006 wouldn't work on it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I can't help that. Oh, and speaking of Windows, by the way, we've already gigged Microsoft or Apple today for a vulnerability. We might as well hit Windows as well.
Equal opportunists.
That's us. As scary as Heartbleed was this past spring, it looks like virtually every Microsoft Windows user is in for a little deja vu. On Tuesday, Microsoft released a critical patch for a huge server vulnerability, one that affects quite a few current versions of Windows out there. As of now, Microsoft isn't aware of anyone actually taking advantage of this vulnerability, which shows a remote code execution vulnerability due to the improper processing of specially crafted packets. In other words, if an attacker modified packets in a particular way and attacked your machine, they might be able to execute whatever code they like remotely without an authorized account. The attack appears to only affect those running on affected platforms, but because at least according to Microsoft, this patch is the only way to fend off any rogue third parties trying to make use of the vulnerability. You should update immediately. So, if you use, now listen to this list. If you use Windows Server 2003, Windows Vista, Windows Server 2008, Windows 7, Windows 8, Windows 8.1, Windows Server 2012, Windows 7 2012 R2, Windows 7, Windows RT, or Windows RT 8.1, which is every single version of Windows that is still supported. You can get the patch either by using your own Windows update or head over to Microsoft support site and download the patch ASAP. Seriously, do it now. Those of you on XP, you're vulnerable, but guess what? No patch for you. So, did you do this week's update? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. Have you noticed I've gotten porky about Windows XP users?
Hello? You think?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I do sympathize. I understand. These are parlous economic times.
No, you don't.
No, I do. I do understand that. If your Windows machine is working fine, particularly if your funds are not up to it at this moment.
Yeah, but then they still keep complaining that, oh, they're getting infected.
Well, right.
And then I've had one machine come in twice.
Yep.
Because it's reinfected. And I go, I told you. It's not supported. There's nothing else I can do.
And we're getting to the point where Microsoft and other companies are starting to take down the XP information from the web. We can't even find stuff to fix it with anymore.
Yeah. No, that's...
We're really past it. You can use anything you want. Don't complain when it breaks or when it gets infected because you went into it with open eyes. It's like saying to somebody, you shouldn't really put diesel into your car.
Yeah, I think.
And then they do, and then they complain to you because it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, get over it.
A computer is a very expensive investment, and you need to treat it that way.
Right, right, right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Chuck from Brighton, New York. Welcome, Chuck. What's up?
Yeah, I've been having some problems with various programs. Sometimes their user interface would appear even when I wasn't clicking on them. So I've been trying to uninstall them. And one of them was iTunes. I never use iTunes, but it had been installed some time in the past. Anyway, so I decided to try to uninstall it. So first, I decided not to use the Windows uninstaller. Instead, I tried to use Revo. In Revo, a whole bunch of, when I launch it, the various programs that are installed in the computer, their mm-hmm. icons appear in their on their user interface, mm-hmm. but iTunes does not.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the regular control panel uninstaller,
mm-hmm.
and sure enough, it was there along with other Apple applications that I wanted to install.
Mm-hmm.
And when I tried uninstalling them using that, it said I kept getting messages saying that it couldn't find the program that I was clicking on. Or it just didn't work. Can you explain what might be happening?
Sounds like it started to uninstall, and somewhere in between it had a hiccup.
Yeah.
So there's a conflict.
The same thing, but instead of uninstall, it was during an install.
Either or, but I mean, it still thinks it's not there,
right?
Even though you're seeing part of it there.
Yeah.
So it could be either or, either during the install or uninstall. Something got messed up. Your system thinks it's gone, but the icons are still there. And the only way you can really...
You got to go into a reputable dealer.
They'd have to go into the registry. Yep. And that's one thing I will not tell you how to even do.
Sure.
To get rid of it.
On Revo, I was trying to use their Hunter mode.
Yep.
Right, where you can click on the Hunter mode and then go in.
Just Revo thinks it's uninstalled also.
But then, you can then go into the Windows Explorer and locate all the files that are associated with iTunes and one by one bring them over to the Hunter icon, which has the flame in it, and you can
zap
them that way.
One of the other programs I would recommend, it's called RegClean.
Yeah.
RegClean, you can run that through because it 10 to 1 odds. It's something in your registry that it still thinks it's there. And if you run RegClean, it looks for links to see if they still exist between, what's on your hard drive. So if you go under Users and you still see iTunes there, you can delete the folder, run RegClean, and then it'll look for any common link between the registry and what folders are on your machine, and try to clean that out for you.
Is RegClean, is that a freeware? Or
mm-hmm.
It is, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing you might also be able to try is downloading the installer for iTunes from Apple's website, running the installer, and then running the uninstall from Windows add remove programs.
Okay.
Right. Do a clean install.
Over top of itself.
Right, and then do an uninstall. That makes sense, too. All right, listen, we got to take a break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Brian Meehan, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 39 minutes after the hour. You're listening to Soundbites on the truly great and solely member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Soundbites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Brian Meehan. And 44 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And we have Dave from Canandaigua, New York on the line. Welcome, Dave. What's up?
Well, a minor rant and a question. And the reason so many people don't want to switch from XP is because they've mangled the user interface so badly that nobody knows how to use anything every time they come out with a new version. And when you run a small business and you have to do everything, that kind of a roadblock is a real annoyance.
I understand that.
Yeah. However, I've moved on to Windows 7, and I've gotten over it mostly. A little bit of therapy,
There you go. Exactly.
So anyway, but one of the things that I'm looking at right now, I have to do I'm an executor for my father's estate, and I'm going through his laptops.
Yeah, sorry.
And he didn't organize things very well, so I need to see everything that's on there. And, of course, I hate laptops because I'm old and stodgy. So, anyway, I've been looking at physical to virtual because I've been using VirtualBox. And the question is, do you think that really works? From what I'm reading, it looks like it's real simple. But there are some software that will go into an actual physical machine and create a virtual file which is compatible with virtual machine.
Yeah. What you're looking at is there are a number of products to do that. And basically what ends up happening is you end up with something like VirtualBox, and you can inside for those of you who don't know what VirtualBox is, VirtualBox is a program that lets you run one operating system inside another. So let's say, for example, I have a Linux machine with 8 gig of RAM or something like that in it. Inside there, I can create a 2 gig Windows machine and run it in a window on my Linux box. And what Dave is talking about is taking his father's entire laptop, turning that into a virtual machine, and then running it in a window on his own machine. And I will tell you, Dave, that it works. It works very well, as a matter of fact. And you certainly don't lose anything trying it, because
right.
the act of virtualizing it doesn't change the original physical machine.
Right.
I would say go for it. It cannot hurt.
Except for the time involved. But
except for the time.
Yeah. But also I would mention that, you know, people who are reluctant to give up their old machines because you lose some kind of functionality and it's hard to make it work in a new environment. Well, you know, move that machine over to a virtual machine. You can hang on to it for as long as you want. And when it dies, you just copy that virtual file over to a new machine, and you still have your old Windows XP or whatever.
Yep.
So, all right.
Yep,
well,
that reminds me. I have a couple of old virtual XP machines that I could fire up inside my Ubuntu box. And see what's in there still. I haven't looked at them in a long time.
Yep. Well, that answers my question for now anyway. Thank you.
Good luck. Thanks, Dave.
Yep.
Yeah, it's there's an interesting setup there when you think about the fact that you buy one machine and then you can virtualize other machines inside it. You can't virtualize Macs very well because they have proprietary chips in them. But you can virtualize Windows or Ubuntu or, well, any Linux, Windows or Linux, on a Windows machine, on a Linux machine, or on a Mac.
Yep. I'd actually gone through similar circumstances with Dave, and he's doing a really important task. Anytime you have a computer that you really want to make sure you have that good working state to go back from, the very first thing you should do is create a good backup of that. So Dave is doing that snapshot in time, so he can always go back to that if he ever loses any of the files or needs to go back to how his father's laptop existed at one point.
Right.
It's a really critical task.
Right. And we see that a lot. A lot of people are doing that to keep old machines running. One of the nice things about that is I use it a lot when I'm doing research on viruses. Because if I have a system that suddenly gets infected, all I have to do is kill it, right? Because what I do is I take a master copy of an operating system, let's say Windows. I create a machine, and once it's running exactly the way I want, I create a master copy of that and put it aside. And now it's not running anymore. It's just a file that's far away from the virtual machine that's running. So I can now do all the testing I want on that, and if I screw it up in some way or I get infected in some way or something bad happens, all I have to do is shut down that virtual machine, throw it away, and make another copy of the master and bring that up instead.
And another reason, Nick, that won't become that's less likely to become infected, it's not your daily machine. So
right.
when you have this very specific task computer and it's not your daily runner, it's going to be a more secure environment to work in.
Right. And I've watched a lot of people use that as they say, oh, I'm interested in Linux and I don't know, how to use it, or I want to play with it a little bit. Set up a virtual box. Now, that said, to set up a virtual box, there's no magic. So you've got to have a lot of disk space. You've got to have a lot of RAM because now you're running two separate operating systems. The real operating system you run every day, and then this virtual one that you're running. So a minimum of a 4 gig machine, or better yet, an 8 gig machine, means that you can run one or even two virtual machines simultaneously, and do stuff in them, learn stuff in them, play around with them. We talked about having some 6.0 version of an accounting program, and I know somebody who actually does that, and he runs it in a virtual machine, in a virtual XP machine, and it's sort of okay because it's not attached to the internet in any way, he keeps a golden master of his XP machine so that he can run it if he needs to, and if he thinks that he's gotten infected somehow, he can just wipe that out and bring back the golden master. He's still got to have his files saved separately, but that's a different issue. But yeah, virtual machines are pretty nifty. In fact, a lot of servers nowadays are virtualized. They don't even run the server hardware doesn't even run a regular operating system. It just runs what's called a hypervisor or a virtual supervisor. So that when you boot it up, all it does is get itself ready to run a half a dozen other operating systems. That's pretty nice.
I have several clients that I support. Even though they only run one server and they only have one physical machine,
right,
I still put that hypervisor on there. And the benefit is that if I have to reboot that machine remotely, I can watch the entire reboot cycle remotely. I can go ahead and actually power it off and power it back on virtually.
Yep.
Without having to be on site.
Yep. And it does mean buying a slightly bigger machine, but it also means some really interesting trade-offs. One of the things we used to do over at Saunders when I was, you know, I'm retired now, so I'm only teaching four classes. I'm an idiot. Back over at Saunders, one of the things that we used to do was everybody had a virtual, all our servers were virtual. So if we needed to give more processors or more RAM or more disk space from one to another, it was real easy to just go in and say click, 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 and boom, it happened magically.
I like magic.
I like magic.
Anything significantly technical enough in nature is indistinguishable from magic.
Exactly, and we love magic. We were experimenting with doing the same thing with desktops, and while we had plenty of bandwidth to do that, we didn't have plenty of system power in the system we were given to do that with. So that didn't work well. But we could do the same thing there. If somebody came to me and said, oh, I've got this giant data set I want to crunch, I could give them extra cores, extra RAM, whatever they needed to do that crunching, and then take it back from them later. Also, if we had to do updates, they never had to worry about it. We would update the master and then just tell them anytime you want, reboot, and you'll get the new version.
It really has changed the way you do systems administration.
Yeah, it really has, and it's made it so much easier and so much faster. I kind of I'm this close to actually envying the guy who took over from me because he gets all that benefit now, and he's the one who did it, so he's, you know, he deserves it. But it's so much easier now to click, click, click.
It's interesting because that is one of the parts of systems administration and computer management that spills over into entirely previously unrelated field, facilities management.
Yep.
They're the people who do your cooling and your space planning. Now we're more efficient to them. So we get to be partners now.
Yep. And we're seeing people like Google who are putting entire server farms on barges and just floating them out to sea and cooling them with the much colder air that they get, you know, up north of Seattle in the ocean, rather than having to stick a bunch of fans on there and all of that stuff. They send them on a little ocean voyage and let them frolic amongst the icebergs up in Canada.
Remember I said decades ago, Freon.
Yeah.
Buy stock in Freon.
Buy stock in
Freon. Liquid nitrogen. Because right, keeping those computers cool is the key.
Yep. Yep.
I mean, you know, they keep wanting them to go faster and faster and faster. Faster and faster. And a board causes heat.
That's right.
Generates a lot of heat. And you've got to be able to dissipate that heat.
I just like to think that my Gmail account is one an all-expense-paid trip to the yeah. coast of Alaska.
But they are. They're putting them on mountains. They're putting them in cold areas mm-hmm. that are at least semi-permanently cold.
They're going north.
They're going north.
Are they still harnessing the power of the waves as the barge goes up and down?
I believe they power? Are. There's a whole bunch of things that Google is doing that just make them the envy of everybody who knows even a little bit about what they're doing. They're harnessing wave energy to power the things. And much of this is still experimental, and they're harnessing the cold to keep the machines cool.
Oh, they're here in Rochester?
Yeah. Yeah. This might today be cold enough for them, but generally not so much.
Jeez Louise.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Now, you look at, I hate winter more than any six people I know, but even I got to say that here it is the middle of November. And we don't even have snow on the ground, maybe the tiniest little bit of snow on the ground. Yeah. That's not bad. You know, you want to, whether you believe in global warming or not, you have a mind and you remember. I remember as a kid, every single winter being angry that I had to go trick or treating in boots and a coat because there was a foot of snow on the ground for October for Halloween.
I remember a couple.
I remember a lot of them. I remember going to school. I remember celebrations. I was a GCB, a good Catholic boy. I remember
hiking both ways up the hill to school.
To school, both in the snow, uphill both ways. But I remember going to Marian devotions. May is the month of Mary, and we were going in winter coats and boots. I remember that. So
we got a good 3 months of good weather here in Rochester.
Yeah, we did, and I even I find it churlish to complain. I admit it.
My brother describes Rochester suburbs.
Yeah,
just as a couple months of bad ice fishing.
Yeah,
but you know, yeah, you're right. I mean, I can remember the days when, you know, well, they came out with a board game for Buffalo because yeah. they used to get blizzards, you know, constantly.
I remember sitting, we were part of a theater company, a resident theater company at Nazareth College. They shut everything down because this wall of snow, they kept calling it the wall of snow, was coming from Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And it was bright, sunny, no snow on the ground. You could see the grass. They closed the school. We raided Wegmans. We all went up and sat in the dorm and looked out the window to the west, waiting for the wall of snow to hit. And we just partied hard. And apparently the wall of snow turned south of Batavia. Never came to us, not ever.
Mm-hmm.
We sat there watching the birds pecking on the ground and the grass and everything. We're thinking, where the hell is this wall of snow business?
I remember folks leaving work and everything else because they were worried they were going to be stranded at work and yada, yada, yada.
A friend of mine has pictures of her and her family sledding out the second floor window of their Watertown home.
What was it?
You know, and they can't do that anymore. So, you know, whatever else you believe about anything or the causes or anything else, winters are getting warmer.
Yeah, because I remember it was January of 65. We got hit by a 3-day storm.
Yeah.
So my dad was home, and I didn't even have to deliver newspapers.
Yep.
For 3 whole days because it was that bad. They couldn't move. They were everything was stranded.
Yep. I remember my father complaining because of the way I piled up snow. It was higher than the car on the sides of the driveway, and he couldn't see to get out of the driveway. And we haven't seen that in a while. Anyway, listen, we're going to take a slightly longer break right now, but because we have finished the first hour of Sound Bites for this week, but don't fret, worry not, soothe and smooth your furrowed brow, because we'll be back with a whole nother hour of the longest running computer show in the known universe. We are Sound Bites with Dave Enright, Brian Meehan, me Nick Francesco, and you. It is 59 minutes after the hour, and we indeed are Sound Bites on the truly great, and don't forget this, solely member supported Jazz 90.1. See you on the other side.
Oh.
online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Henry.
And I'm Brian Meehan.
And at 4 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. I'm very excited to say that I ordered a Nexus player, and I think it's due to be delivered today, I think. It's in Rochester, which probably means it won't be delivered till Tuesday or Wednesday. But Google has announced... Hey.
The truth is the truth.
The truth is the truth. Google has announced that the Chromecast app lineup... for those of you with Chromecasts, and the Nexus player has essentially a Chromecast in it. The lineup will include family-friendly video games and two new entertainment channels. Classic titles such as Wheel of Fortune, Scrabble Blitz, and Monopoly Dash are being made available, along with dance and trivia games like Big Web Quiz, which utilizes Google's Knowledge Graph to generate questions. How cool is that? Apps can be downloaded from Google Play or the iOS App Store, allowing phones and tablets to be used as controllers for Chromecast's library of games, removing the need for extraneous peripherals. The actual game board will be displayed on the TV. Those who prefer more sedentary entertainment can opt for videos from Showtime Anywhere and Stars. In a bid to lure new subscribers, Google is also providing 2 free months of Hulu Plus and 90 days of Google Play All Access Music to anyone with a Chromecast. So, does this tempt you into either a Chromecast or a Nexus player? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415. I'm particularly interested, like I said, I've got a Chromecast, and I really love it, but I'm getting the Nexus player because that has Netflix and a few other things actually built in. So I don't even have to run those on my phone to get them to the television.
Now we'll ask the weekly question.
Sure. No, not yet.
No?
Shut up. Shut up.
I saw a truck going down your street.
Oh, you
son of a pup,
you.
They must have been going the other way, huh?
You stinking son of a pup, you. I hate you in ways I can't begin to describe on the radio.
There's a lot of love here.
There's a lot of love in this room. What we're, of course, talking about is that Green Light Networks is coming to my neighborhood. See? See? Okay, now you're on his side. See? See?
No, they're just going by Nick's house. They'll probably come to yours.
Yeah, right.
They're going to sit outside of Nick's house and just purposely go to the house to the left, the house to the right, and go right around.
My full expectation is that they're going to beep every time they go by. Beep, beep. So long. You could have waved with all your fingers. But anyway, here's the thing. Greenlight Networks is fiber to the home.
Except Nick Francesco.
Except Nick Francesco's home. 100 megabits for $50 a month, a gigabit for $250 a month. That translates to hellacious fast. I'm waiting for it to hit my neighborhood. One of the things that makes cord cutters very happy is speed, because it means there's no wait. If I'm watching one show, my wife's watching another show, my daughter's watching a third show, the dog's got something else on, we can all watch what we want to watch without any buffering or any slowdown or any of that nonsense. It's fairly inexpensive. The other wonderful thing about Greenlight Networks is they're saying no caps, which means you can use as much data as you want, which makes sense, and they're not blocking any ports. So if you want to run your own mail server, whatever you want to do, you can do that.
Mm-hmm. And they're not bundling anything else. That you
right.
buy exactly what they're offering, and you don't. In order to get that faster package, you don't have to also buy these other things you don't need or want.
Right. Right.
Well, you know, that's why I think, you know, there's another company in town right now. They've sort of backed off because of the way right now a lot of the major networks and that are offering their network for, you know, $8 a month. So if you like, say, CBS or TNT or these, you're going to see eventually, because that's been always one of my biggest gripes about cable TV, is I pay for channels that I have never watched, will never watch in my whole lifetime.
Right.
But
in
it's
fact,
part of the
Lifetime
bundle.
You probably won't watch.
Yeah.
I'm not going to watch Lifetime. I'm probably never going to watch the
QVC.
Hockey channels. I'm never going to watch QVC.
And this is nothing against anybody else, but the Spanish channels. I don't speak Spanish.
Right.
So they don't appeal to me. Other folks that want it, they can get it.
Right.
But, you know, to be able to pick and choose.
Back in the day when I was promised flying cars, I was also promised a la carte television.
Yes, you were, and you're not getting it. But now you can. Everybody's offering it. The thing I just showed you, Stars, now you'll be able to buy separately. CBS, you'll be able to buy their shows separately.
HBO, which is a big thing. Now Game of Thrones is now available. You can get this their new offering without having to have a cable subscription, and
right.
That's enormous.
It's huge. And we're seeing more and more of that as these entertainment companies are realizing that they can actually make more money separating the content provider from the wire provider.
Right. You know, go be a media developer. You know, be that content creator and do that well. And then let the people who run the wires run the wires.
Right. Exactly. And let's keep them separate with the problems that we've been having are all because the people who own the wires and the people who own the entertainment are the same people. Right? So you're only ever going to get what they want you to have. And, for example, there's a Kung Fu channel I can't get here in Rochester. I know.
That's a disaster of astronomical
proportions. I know. And so there's an issue there that...
Crouching Tiger, Hidden Channel. One day I have a dream, Nick, that I will be able to fire up some device, maybe it'll be right built into my television, and with my remote control, I can install a television channel in the same way that I can download an app from an app store, and for $1.99, I have that channel on some sort of interface that I can then go watch that channel and that content and have it completely separate from the time of day, so I watch the content I want on my schedule, and rainbows and sunshine and unicorns.
Exactly, and that's all you need. Double rainbows, man. Double rainbows all the way. That's what we need, and we're starting to see it. We're starting to see, for example, and Netflix started it, you know? And this whole idea of binge watching.
Yes.
Watching an entire season series all at once. I'm a child of the 50s, so, you know, I'm used to appointment television. Once a year, we could sit down on a specific Thursday night and watch The Wizard of Oz, and the family gathered around and did that. But I very quickly have taken to binge watching, I can watch the entire season of X at once. Yes, please. Think I'll do that right now.
Yeah, I'll hold off on watching one. And of course, you have to block your Twitter account so that you don't see spoilers.
Right.
But, you know, I'm not watching the rest of Homeland until all the episodes are out so I can watch them end to end.
That's exactly right.
I don't need that kind of suspense in my life.
Right. Right. And we're seeing that with a lot of stuff. HBO does it now with HBO to Go. Netflix has TV shows where they just put out the whole season. There you go. Knock yourself out. Watch it all. Perfect. And they're putting out a bunch of new shows. A bunch of Marvel comics are being translated to live action on there. But we should probably go to the phones, talk to Carolyn from Greece. Is it Carolyn or Caroline?
Carolyn.
Carolyn from Greece, New York. Welcome, Carolyn. What's up?
Nick, I read your article in the paper about calibrating a battery for a laptop.
Yes.
Now, I assume I would follow that same procedure for my tablet. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I do have to be a little cautious. Almost every battery can do this.
Okay.
And it doesn't. It's not the fountain of youth, right? You're not going to bring a battery all the way back to the day you bought it. But what happens is if you drain it and fill it and drain it and fill it, it comes back much, much, much better than it was.
Okay. Now, I've drained it down to like 7 or 8%, but I've never drained it down to nothing. Do you really have to get it down to nothing?
The nothinger you get it, the better off you are.
Okay. I was always afraid it would never come back.
No. Unless the battery is damaged, it will come back.
Well, I don't think it is, so hope not.
Yeah.
Is it okay to plug it in and leave it overnight?
I do.
Me too.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I'd want to leave it 5 or 6 days.
No, no. I just plug it in when I go to bed, and then when I get up in the morning, I unplug it.
Yeah.
That's okay?
Almost all of them nowadays have a circuit that just simply stops charging when it's charged.
Okay. All right.
Or they'll calibrate at the top of the charge cycle where they'll drain it a little bit and then charge it back up to 100 or even a little bit more than 100%. I know that defies the laws of math.
Right. But yeah, and that's another reason that you want to, you know, once in a great while, and I'm not saying you do this daily or monthly or whatever, but once in a great while, you want to recalibrate the battery by just draining it all the way down 2 or 3 times.
Okay, and it'll come back, you promise.
I promise.
Okay.
All right.
I also read someplace on the internet that if you're not doing this calibration process, that you should only charge it to 80%. And then only drain it to 20%?
Never heard that.
No. Never heard that? Okay. No. All right, so I can just charge it up.
And remember, the batteries are a finite life.
Yes.
Know, about 3 years out of a battery.
Yeah, the reality is, that's why I said, you know, it's not a fountain of youth.
Mm-hmm.
Batteries get old just like all of us, and we don't always charge back up to 100%.
I know that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right, good luck.
Yep, bye-bye.
Bye. Probably shouldn't have built her all the way up and then ended with good luck. But yeah, batteries, we find that with a lot of things. The problem is we all want to make sure that our phones and our laptops and everything else are fully charged when we need them, so we don't let them drain as much as we really should.
I think it's, the new LG that they're showing?
Yeah.
That, you know, say it gets down real low, you can quick hook it up, and I think it's...
You get an 80% charge in like 15 minutes? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, fast charge.
Yeah.
The Motomax? Yeah, the commercial with the guys falling off the side of the building.
Yeah.
Well, there's another one. He's in a bar?
Yeah, he's in a bar.
It's the same
end.
One. Oh, at the end, he's in a bar.
Same
as all James Franco. Yeah. We're finding... The thing there's really one major thing that's lagged behind, and that's battery technology.
Mm-hmm.
If we had if the battery technology had kept up to, say, processor technology, we would have flying cars.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't have any oil crisis ever because we'd all have batteries that lasted a year.
Yep.
And our laptops, our phones, we wouldn't ever worry about charging them.
Yeah, if you look inside any modern tablet or phone device, most of the bulk of that device is a battery.
Yep.
We just haven't figured out how to make them small enough, strong enough, big enough.
Just to last longer. I mean, that's the main reason I got my Razer Max X.
Yep.
The long battery life. And
we want them to do more stuff.
Yeah, and with me using it throughout the whole day, evenings as texting and talking and everything else, usually I only get down to maybe 60-65%.
And I do the same thing, and then I charge it up overnight.
Yeah, same
here. What I'm doing is teaching my battery that 65% is out of power.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, as we were talking with Carolyn, you want to recalibrate your batteries once in a while. That's your laptop, your phone, your watch, your everything. Every once in a while, drain it all the way down, charge it all the way up, drain it all the way down, charge it all the way up. Maybe do that 3 times, and then you should be good for a while yet.
It's sort of like my battery.
Oh, my battery, I just, coffee. All I need is coffee. A lot of coffee. Exactly.
It gets drained, totally drained very easily.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Now, Brian has the Moto 360 watch.
I do.
Yeah. And I hate him because it's so cool.
It is a very sleek looking device.
But it does need a charge, just like everything else. If you get a day out of it, you're lucky because, again, the battery technology has simply not kept up. You know, again, if battery technology had kept up, you maybe have to recharge it once a week.
And things like the Pebble are closer to that, but they do less. And when you want a device that actively listening to your voice and doing voice dictation and giving you a color screen, you're gonna be drawing more power.
Yep. All right, arriba, andale. The Corega music tells me that we are full of bull, and we are about to take another break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Brian Meehan. Thank God nobody important is listening to this station. And me, Nick Francesco, it's 19 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites on the member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Brian Meehan.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we have Dennis from Rochester, New York on the line. Welcome, Dennis. What's up?
Well, you were talking about virtual Windows. I have a machine, a quad-core, with 8 gigabytes of memory that I haven't even... It's a Windows 7, and I'm about to... get the crapola off of it and get it running. And so that sounds like it would be powerful enough to create a virtual, whatever you call it, virtual
yes.
window.
Yep.
How do I go about doing that? I mean, do I have to go find a program somewhere to do that?
You have to make a decision right at the start. If you want to have a bare metal system or if you want to run your regular Windows 7 desktop and then also, on occasion, run virtual machines.
Well, yeah, that sounds like more what I'd like to do. Okay. I mean, could I take my girlfriend's laptop, which may or may not have a virus, definitely needs a lot of updates and a lot of cleaning. Could I run that as a virtual window on my it's Windows 7. Could I run that as a separate virtual window on my Windows 7 tower?
You could, yeah. So you would start by installing your regular Windows 7 operating system, get it up and running, patch it.
This is on your main machine, not on the laptop.
Right.
Right, that machine with 8 gigs of RAM. Get it up and running and get it installed the way you want.
Okay.
And then you're going to download a piece of software called VirtualBox. VirtualBox is an application, so it launches just like Microsoft Word or Google Chrome would.
Okay.
Once that's installed, you have the option of installing a new copy of Windows, and you do that the exact same way you would as you just completed on the physical machine.
Only you're now doing it inside VirtualBox.
Okay, why would I need to the option of installing a new another copy of Windows 7? Wouldn't I just transfer over or open up the window with my girlfriend's laptop Windows 7? I'm a little confused.
Well, yeah, we're just giving you an example.
Right. If you wanted to take your girlfriend's computer, the easiest way to do that what they call a physical to virtual conversion,
mm-hmm.
is to take one of her backups, boot from the Windows 7 CD,
mm-hmm.
and choose Restore from Backup.
Okay.
Inside VirtualBox.
Right.
Okay.
So you're gonna put the CD into your physical computer, that one with 8 gigs of RAM.
Mm-hmm.
You're gonna launch the VirtualBox software, and it's gonna say, what should I boot from? And at this point, you have a pristine system, a pristine virtual system. You're going to tell it to boot from that CD that you have, or that DVD in the drive.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to spin up and say, hey, do you want to install Windows? And you don't. You want to restore from backup. You're going to plug in your USB drive, and you're going to restore your girlfriend's backup from her computer.
I see. Can I do updates for her Windows for her in that virtual?
You're not remotely
controlling.
No, you're not remotely controlling her machine. That's a different thing.
You're making a copy of it.
Oh,
right. So this is not remote control of her system.
Is that what you're looking for?
Well, I thought I could. I'd rather work at a desktop with a large computer, a screen, rather than working at the laptop, which has a smaller keyboard.
Right.
Smaller screen. But she needs to have updates done and a lot of stuff done to it, so I thought maybe I could do that within the virtual.
So that's not really a virtual. It seems a lot like it. What you're doing there is remote controlling her computer. And as systems administrators, we do that all the time. If it's a Windows machine, you can use the built-in software called Windows or Microsoft Remote Desktop, which is bundled with every copy of Windows 7, Windows 8, all the way back to Windows XP.
Ah.
And simply point it to her computer. You'll log in with her username and password, and then you'll be presented. Her laptop will say that it's locked and in use, and you will have access to her computer as if you were sitting at it.
And I would do that. I would do that on my box with the 8 gigabytes of RAM.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And RAM isn't even that much of a consideration at that point, because you're really her computer is doing all the heavy lifting. It's just you're another monitor, basically.
Yeah, you're essentially looking at her stuff on your monitor.
Ah, okay. That sounds easier than doing the virtual box then.
Yes.
Right, and that's called remote desktop connection, which you can install on her machine. Actually, it's installed. You just have to set it up, and then give it. You know, go to your machine and connect to her machine over the internet using whatever the address is of her machine.
Could I just use a USB cable connection between the two machines, or not?
No, that would just be for transferring data.
Oh, okay.
Right. So you do this over. So you're sitting at home on your network. She's sitting there with you at her on her machine on your network.
Yep, she uses the Wi-Fi that I have.
There you go. So that's how that would work. You would connect via your own local intranet, and then as long as her machine is turned on and running, you can then get on it and do all this stuff.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So I'm using the same network that we're already on, and
yes.
We can see each other on the network.
Yep.
Okay, very good. That's helpful. Thank you very much.
There you go. And it's called Remote Desktop Connection. So you should be able to find that pretty easily. Sorry. I wanted to read this news story because, again, I'm waiting for my Nexus player, and I should see all this stuff shortly. We're in a music sales apocalypse. While streaming music grows. So it's no surprise Google Music's on-demand streaming service subscriber numbers are growing. But somehow, Google's download sales are growing too, according to Google's VP of Global Music Partnerships, Zahava Levine.
How can that be?
How can that be? She refused to reveal any concrete subscriber numbers, but said not only are our subscribers growing, but our download numbers are growing despite the industry trend. That trend saw a digital track sales saw digital track sales down 13% in the first half of 2014 compared to the first half of 2013.
Maybe they're just making lousier music.
We know they are. Google launched its clumsily named Google Play Music All Access on-demand streaming service in May 2013 as a competitor to independent apps like Spotify and RDO. It acquired curated playlist service Songza in July to humanize its comparably dry music app. Levine said that it now hosts 30 million songs for streaming, while also running its Music Locker service for streaming your own collection to other devices and its Google Play Music Store. So that's really a nice feature that I use all the time. I've got a lot of CDs. And I've uploaded them all to the Google Music Player. And so I can play my music, which it knows I own because I owned the CD, anytime I want. So that's really kind of a very nice thing. Together, Levine says Google Play Music generates hundreds of millions of dollars per year for the music industry. But the division's focus right now is on growing its subscriber count because she says streaming only becomes profitable at scale. Eventually, Google Music will look to premium features to draw in its subscribers, said Levine, mentioning high-definition recordings as one potential draw. But why would Google operate a music store and streaming service simultaneously? I do not believe the subscription service cannibalizes sales, she said. She then relayed a very fascinating fact to prove it. We launched our store a year and a half before our subscription service. If you look at our subscribers who all came after our store, most of our subscribers buy music after becoming a subscriber rather than stop buying music after becoming a subscriber. She concludes we're not seeing cannibalization. Levine admitted she didn't know if sales were up on a per-user basis, but said that for Android users without iTunes accents, Google Play is essentially the only way to buy music. With over 1 billion active Android users, that means there are still plenty of people buying music. 67% of the revenue last year came from sales, Levine said, referring to sales as a percentage of record music revenue. We are still in a world where more people are buying music than subscribing. We're going to be in a world that supports both access and ownership. For many years, there is room for both models. So do you buy or stream music more often? Why? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-5299. 790-0415. Just like Al did from Macedon, New York. Welcome, Al. What's up? Al, are you there? Hold on. We're missing Al. Don't go away, Al. We're desperately trying to drag you back from the ether limbo that you are currently in. Let's see if we got you. Al, are you there? Al? Al, buddy, hang on. We'll find you. You're out there somewhere. We won't abandon you. Or maybe we will, apparently.
And someone, if we call you, we'll call you Al.
Speaking of old music. I stream most of my music these days.
I have that song in my Google Play All Access collection.
There you go.
It's incredibly useful because it's there cross-platform. It's there on my Chromebook. It's there on my laptop. It's there on tablet, across Apple and Mac and PC and Linux products. If I can open up a web browser, I can listen to my music from anywhere.
Yep, that's exactly right. All right, we're going instead to Mike from Rochester, New York. Al, call back if you can. Welcome, Mike. What's up?
Hi there. Question, what is the status? What's your understanding of the Comcast-Time Warner merger? What's the, you know, I heard a thing on the radio tonight, or this week, and it seemed like there was, that they're going to require them with regulations and so forth. I was just wondering what the actual, you know, what your understanding of it is.
Well, first, let's understand that I'm not privy to anything special, right? I mean, I don't know any more than the average citizen does. There are certainly the basic point here is that Comcast and Time Warner want to merge to create one gigantic company. Now, as of earlier this week. Today's the 15th, so Thursday. The New York State Public Service Commission delayed its final decision on the merger. Right? Yep. So there was a November 19th deadline. That's now gone, and the new deadline is December 31st.
You know what I wish the Public Service Commission had told them? We'll get back to you sometime between 12 and 4 o'clock.
On December 31st.
Well, the thing that I heard on the radio this week was that, one of the things they were looking for was everyone that would live in public housing in New York City would receive free internet.
I don't think so. I don't believe that's true. But there is an awful lot of complexity in this transaction, and there's a lot of... a potential impact on residents of New York State. There's also that ongoing legal dispute over the possible public release of information that both cable companies argue is proprietary and confidential, but public interest groups are saying, otherwise, and they want details about various broadband subscriptions, future expansion plans, the possible fate of Time Warner Cable's $15 internet plan, and that's a very tough thing for them to do because, of course, that's all private information that's part of what makes them a competitive corporation. So just handing that stuff over is very hard for them. On the other hand, the Public Service Commission is saying, yeah, without that information, we can't make a decision. So that's where that stands. I don't know that anybody has said, and I've not heard that from a single reputable source, giving free internet to anybody.
The woman that was talking, I wish I could have got her name and everything. I was driving home from work, and her thoughts were, and correctly, that a child growing up in 2014 needs high speed internet.
Absolutely,
competitive at school. Yeah, I like that part of it, but then when she said, well, we're going to require them to, we would like them to give free internet to everybody that's in public housing, old age homes and so forth. And I'm thinking, and then they said, well, what about upstate? And she says, well, we're looking at old age homes there. And I'm thinking,
somebody who runs some little organization that's demanding something doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that makes sense to me. I mean, if you want to talk about free fiber to the home, Google is doing that. If they get 70% of a neighborhood to sign up for gigabit internet, they'll give 350 megabits to the rest of the neighborhood for free. You still have to pay for installation, but you don't have to pay for the connection as long as 70% of the neighborhood is paying for it. But that's their decision, and they're only doing that in a couple of cities in the country anyway. So I don't believe there's any bill or legislative action anywhere to demand free internet for anybody. I agree with you. I think there should be internet for everybody. I think it's becoming more and more a basic human right rather than a luxury. But I don't think there's any bill or other legislative action to force it to happen.
Okay. Good show, yes.
All right. Thanks. Again, you probably need to be aware that I'm not a lawyer and I don't even play one on television anymore. So, but I don't think there is. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Brian Meehan, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 39 minutes after the hour. We are Soundbites on the solely member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1. Turn your radio down. 2. Turn your radio down lower. 3. Remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4. Make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5. Calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Brian Meehan.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites, and we have Al from Macedon back on the line. Welcome, Al. What's up?
You found me.
We found you. You were lost, but now you are found.
Okay, I've got a question for you. I'm thinking about getting a Surface Pro.
Yeah?
And it's between the 3 or the 2. And I'm wondering if it'll do the function that I want it to do, serve the purpose that I want it to do. I have a Quicken program, a bookkeeping program, that I want to be able to carry portably with me. But I wanted to communicate with my laptop and keep itself up to date. Can that be done with the cloud, or what other mechanism? Can they communicate with each other so that when I put the information into the laptop, it automatically goes to the Surface Pro? When I go out on the road, I'll have that information.
You could store your Quicken files in a Dropbox or a OneDrive folder. OneDrive comes with a Surface Pro tablet. And then they'd be accessible no matter which device you're on, synchronized. You wouldn't want to use them from both devices at the same time. I wouldn't recommend that.
No, I don't want to use both. I just want to have the portability of the simpler Surface Pro to carry around with me rather than carrying a laptop around with me.
Now, how does your laptop compare as far as horsepower? Because the Surface Pro can also be used as a laptop.
Yeah, well, I've got a high-end laptop that I use for my home bookkeeping.
Okay.
All right, there are a couple of things. I know it works on the 3. I don't know that it works on the 2. I can't promise that.
Yeah, that was my... So then I'll just go with the 3 because I was wondering about that too, because I could go El Cheapo for the 2. It doesn't cost much, but I don't mind spending more. And do you think I should get the upper-end one and or should I get the lower end 3?
Well, it depends on how fast you need your Quicken answers.
Okay.
Right? If you don't mind waiting an extra second or two, then the lower end one is fine. But okay. If you really need an answer faster, then the upper end one is better. The other thing you should be aware of is that there are some issues with the font size on Quicken. You have to be careful when you set your font sizes. Because they start up, because the resolution is so fine on the Quicken on the Pro 3 that you start off with very, very tiny text.
Okay.
So you need to adjust that. You just need to deal with it. Just be aware of it.
It's a good product.
It seems to be. I don't own one at the moment, but they seem awfully nice. They're tablet laptopy things, so you have to be as careful as you do with every type of tablet, of course, in
sure.
terms of dropping and breaking. But it
right.
seems, you know, I know people who have them. They've had them for what, a year now or more, and they're happy with them.
I haven't owned one, but I've used the Surface Pro, and I was really pleased with it. If I had to pick one up, I would certainly pick one, either that or the Yoga Pro 3.
Right.
Both are really nice devices. The benefit of the Yoga.
What other Pro 3 is there?
The Yoga, Lenovo's Yoga Pro 3.
Yeah, good. I'm glad you brought that up because I saw that commercial start to come around. And how? What do you think comparably? Because I'm not that savvy.
So the Yoga Pro 3 has the built-in keyboard. It's attached and folds around back, recessing
okay.
the keyboard away so that when you're using it as a tablet, pretty slick device.
And
okay.
you stand less, obviously, chance of losing the keyboard or misplacing it because it's actually attached.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
there are times when you want a keyboard.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The only thing I would caution you when picking up one of these is remember that they're not really upgradable. Or I'll take the word really out. They're not upgradable. So the specs you buy them with at the onset is going to dictate how long that device is going to live with you.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because that's where I was torn. And I thought, shit, I might as well just go for the best one. And
yeah, go high end.
Way I might have the best longevity out of it.
That's it.
Go
you
big
got
or go
it.
Home.
You yep. got it exactly.
Well, thank you guys. Thanks for your helping me out with that.
Thanks. Let us know how you like it.
Okay, I will. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Al.
Bye bye.
That's the tough part of buying any of these things, you know. The only thing you can really test ahead of time is how nice the screen looks,
yep.
Because you'll see it in the store and maybe type a little bit on the keyboard and see if you like that. I tell people all the time when they say, should I get a Chromebook? Well, I first tell them, get my book. But at Amazon, it's called, I just bought a Chromebook, help. But beyond that, I tell them you can play with your go into Chrome on your desktop and just live in Chrome for a while. Anything you do in Chrome, you can do on your Chromebook. But that's the only system I know of where you can really ahead of time decide whether or not that's useful to you. Right? Everything else, it's going to be Windows, so you can see that it's Windows. But what you're really paying attention to is the hardware. And that's hard to know how well that's going to suit you until you've played with it for a while.
And now that all the manufacturers are getting into everything is soldered, nothing is openable, you cannot
yep.
put new stuff in it, we're at a planned obsolescence of hardware.
Yep, we really are. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Lynn from Clymer, New York. Welcome, Lynn. What's up?
A lot less snow than there was yesterday.
Yeah, we don't use the S word, Lynn.
We do down here.
Yeah, you do.
Anyway, the reason I was calling, there's something been bugging me for a long time, and you are the guys that can answer it.
Yeah, maybe.
It's always bothered me. I have never gone into my checking account or my credit card account because I'm going to be opening that in the browser.
Right.
And if I do that and the browser saves temp files, what is the proper procedure then to clear all temp files after you get off? Or it seems to me that if you get a malware on there and it's scouting around for what's in your computer,
yep.
that everything's going to be available to them.
Yep, you're right. Generally speaking, most banks nowadays are using the secure web browsing capabilities, HTTPS. The S stands for secure.
Yeah, okay.
And when you sign out, the act of signing out theoretically will clear out the cache.
Oh, I never heard that.
Well, I don't. It depends, right? It depends on how well they've written their software.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, when you close a window that is HTTPS, then the cache gets removed as well. That's part of the security.
Mm-hmm.
So if you theoretically, if you log out of your bank and then close your browser entirely, theoretically, and only theoretically, that secures everything for you.
So in other words, you should use a browser that you don't have a lot of tabs open in, so yeah, you can close it completely.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, at home, I don't worry about that, of course, because it's my home machine and blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, I still worry about it. I just don't. I'm not a fanatic about it.
Yeah.
But when I'm out, I either don't bank or I make sure that I immediately shut down my browser.
That's not a problem for me because I would have no interest in doing it if I wasn't here at home because I'm here almost 100% of the time. Right. Then I had another question, if you've got time.
Go ahead.
You got any ideas about a substitute for the Windows notification area where you can have more calendars and different calendars with different features on it and so on than what Windows has? You know any of them that are particularly good?
Oh, that's a very good question.
So like a different calendar app?
Well, I think the whole notifications area can get changed so you can have clocks, different clocks for different parts of the world and different calendars so you could have, well, say
you can
like,
customize it. I don't know if you can replace it, but you can certainly customize it.
Perhaps maybe a desktop widget might be something that's a little bit more suitable for that task?
Most of the, in Windows, the widgets are pretty near every time I update, it disables them. Because they don't consider gadgets to be safe.
Yeah. But yeah. You should be able to customize them in any way you want just by opening up the notifications, and right at the bottom of that little square window, it'll say customize.
And you can add more calendars or different type of calendar with more information in it and all that stuff.
So you're looking at the pop-up that you get when you use, say, Outlook or something in, down in the lower right-hand corner?
Yeah, like, you know, instead of getting up and going to the calendar you got on the wall, because I have to get my nose against it before I can see it.
Right.
If I had it right there and I just pop it up and it could have the holidays on it and all that stuff, which Microsoft has done away with, which seeing they supply that internationally, I understand that.
Right.
But I'm quite sure that there are companies or whatever vendors that have replacements for that that can be installed
There's a program called Date in Tray that will do that. That will show you some stuff. But I'm sorry, Lynn, we got to go.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Yep, we're done for another week. I want to thank Dave Enright, especially want to thank Brian Meehan, who did a great job. Don't go away because George is in to play the best German music you will hear all week long. Michael is here to keep him on the straight and narrow, so I think we're in good shape. And we'll be back next week with a whole lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.